This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings out there to everybody at TFMR. All right, it's Thursday, September the 30th. It's time for your Thursday conversation. We're actually recording this late on Wednesday the 29th, which has been a real gnarly day in the shares, in gold, and particularly in COMEX silver. So you may be catching Joe and I both in a gnarly mood. We'll see. But it's a great pleasure to bring in Joe Mazumdar. Of course, if you don't know Joe, you may recognize his website, his newsletter, Exploration Insights. Remember, that was something that we knew with Brent Cook back in the day. And Brent handed off to Joe a few years back. And now Joe is the publisher and editor and runs the website. And so with all that's going on in the world and some of the news this week, I thought, well, let's get Joe in here and get some answers straight from him. So, Joe, thank you so much for joining me. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Craig. A pleasure to be on again.
My friend, before we get started, I've been, since you've been running the show and back when Brent had the reins, I've always been a proponent of what you guys do. It's fun when they go up. It's fun to be in the mining sector. And a lot of times, you know, if you're just in at the right time, it's just the rising tide lifts all boats. But even when things are going up, you need help. You need to know specifics of, who knows? I mean, there are very few lay people, if you will, that can read drill results and be economic geologists and the like. So anyway, before we get started, tell everybody about what you do, about the newsletter and where they can go to get it.
Okay, thanks. So it's explorationinsights.com. It's a weekly newsletter that I talk about what I'm buying and selling, and also thematics, like we're going to discuss some of those thematics right now about potential cost pressures on the industry, the recent mega merger between Kirkland and Agnico. Those are sort of things that I talk about in the letter. But also, you know, I publish every now and then free things for people, like the last one. The one I'm putting out right now in the next week would be about this ESG rant that I did about, is the gold industry investable from an ESG perspective? And so that's something that I've dealt with and, that I'll be putting on the website that people can go to the website and get, or go to contact us and email me directly and I'll send them a copy.
So weekly, as you said.
It is weekly, it can be a bit of a stress finding. When I first took it over, I wondered whether I'd have something to talk about every week. But as you know, there's always something to talk about, isn't there, Craig?
Sure, no doubt about that. And I would imagine you maintain a list of what you own and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, so that the one thing somebody told me, like, was Beaver Creek was actually the access our subscribers have to a wealth of information, not only yep. with the portfolio, but in previous letters and topics that we've discussed, that, as you know, given the cyclical nature of the resource industry, that we might have talked about previously. And as people redo the same assets and give them a different name, we actually have discussions about what that asset was before. And as we know, geology doesn't really change that quickly over decades. So it's good that we've got between Brent and myself now about 14 years of this continuous letter being run.
Yeah. And like you said, full of excellent information and helpful to be able to look back. Joe, I tell you, what an interesting time we have on our hands here in 2021. As you listen to these Thursday conversation podcasts, we always try to kind of keep them on just a couple of major points. There's so many things I want to ask you, but I think I'll start with kind of a general question. You know, it's been now over a year that prices have of the metals, gold and silver at least, have underperformed or surprisingly gone down versus the real interest rate scenario and a number of things we thought would make them go up. And the shares have kind of led that charge. The GDX down from 46 to 29. The GDXJ broke down even further and faster. in the big picture, Joe, Rick Rule told me earlier this week, bull markets don't last 2 years. Okay. Generally they're more like 10 or 11. So in a big picture, are we still in kind of a bull market in the shares? And this is just a pullback, or is, do you sense something more significant going on?
There definitely, like over the last several years, with the mega mergers that we've seen with Barrick, Randgold, and Newmont Goldcorp, and now Kirkland and Agnico, the idea has been to attract the general investor into the sector, into the gold sector, and wean them off of the passive investing in the ETF by showing them that you can maintain generate free cash flow, and then also pay dividends. And that dividend would be what basically distinguishes you from the ETF, which most ETFs don't pay dividends. So that would attract the BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the Vanguards of the world towards the gold sector. But the difference between the resource investing fund that's basically focused on resource or precious metals or something like that, that's the sandbox they play in. So they will look at the best people, the best companies within that sandbox. Whereas the generalist is more of a macro investor that looks at a whole bunch of sectors and has their choice of sectors to invest in. So when they see something like, oh, look at real interest rates, which is a drop, a negative trend in real interest rates. It's what attracted me to the sector and what drove the gold price up to all-time peaks last year in the summer of 2020. Basically, the idea that the tapering is going to end and the real rates are going to go up, even though it doesn't matter that they remain negative right now, but that the trend is going up, has led a lot of the generalist investors, like a BlackRock manager saying a couple of weeks ago that they had a significant position in gold, to saying that they have basically next to none.
And do you think, Joe, and I guess this is my second question for you. I did an interview a couple of days ago with David Garofalo, who was a longtime CEO of Goldcorp. So he knows obviously a little bit about running major miners, and he said something to me that I gotta admit I'd failed to consider, and that, not only is price coming down, but input costs, the main one is energy, are rising.
Yeah.
And so these major producers are really getting squeezed with their margins, and that's going to be reflected in earnings. And so you've got these generalists, as you said, that's got to be driving them away as well.
Yeah, I think if the sector was more positive for them and real interest rates were going negative, they'd probably stay in the sector and look for the best of the best within the sector. But I think the macro was turning them off of the sector.
Yeah.
So resource-specific investors would look at the thing that you're talking about as potential margin squeezes that we're seeing. So I looked at about 12 companies and compared their quarterly, that was the June ending quarter, versus the Q3 of last year, and just looked at their revenues, costs, and gross profits. And what I saw was a flat to downward trend in revenue, mostly commodity related, but the costs on average were going up 10 to 15%. And I'm not even talking about capital, which are driving down the margins by about 15%. And that trend is, one is labor. And like you said, energy, like Goldman Sachs is now predicting or forecasting that, WTI might get up to $90 a barrel. Mm-hmm. When, it was at whatever, 20 to 40, and then was negative at one point. But, and most companies are using $60 in terms of their input costs. So that would also have an impact on companies, because obviously a lot of the trucks are run by diesel and some of the power is run by heavy fuel oil and diesel as well. So there's quite a bit of exposure there. But also the supply chain issues that we're seeing globally are another factor that are impacting not only the cost of your supply chain items, but also the availability. And that's not only impacting producers, but we're also seeing the paucity of news flow from exploration companies as the assay labs are still taking 6 to 8 weeks to give you back a result.
Yep.
So, and in the capital, like we're not seeing a big push in terms of a lot of people building projects right now, like we did in the last cycle that were saying, okay, I could sell you a truck with no tires. But now what we have is like Côté Lake, which is being built by IAM Gold in Northern Ontario, that's been hit by a capital escalation of about $250 million on the ticket to build that. So it is evident. It doesn't appear to be transient. It's here.
I guess this is what my concern then is, Joe. You know, I'm sure a lot of people on the site think this too. They think, well, okay, if you know, price stabilizes here, we get the worst behind us, and gold starts to move back up because the Fed can't taper to zero and all these different things. And gold goes back up to 1800, 1850. I almost feel lazy thinking, oh, okay, so the shares will just turn and go back up. This is a little more complicated stew than that, given all that you just laid out.
Yes, it is, because the margins won't be the same as the margins they enjoyed in the summer of 2020.
Uh-huh.
Because we didn't see that capital escalation impact from COVID and the global supply chains and the knock-on impacts for that. Now we're seeing that. And that same argument that you would say, oh, you know, if inflation is real and it's going up, then real rates, if the interest rates don't change, should be going down, which is positive for gold. But the problem is, if the costs rise higher than the gold price, then your margin would get squeezed, because in the end, the gold sector, we're price takers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess unwittingly, I've kind of made a case for stock selection and exploration insights. Now, it wasn't what I set out to do, but it definitely leads me to think, I mean, if I'm right, if we're all right, that eventually this turns and prices move back higher due to economic, you know, some of the fundamental stuff that's going on. It's not just like you said, it's not just buy the GLD and ride it. You're going to have to be a little more specific. You know, the economics of each company are going to matter.
Yes. And what we see now, at the end of the last cycle, we saw really badly, you know, the people's balance sheets were very highly levered. People weren't generating a lot of free cash flow. They couldn't meet their dividends. That's not the case right now. Companies' balance sheets are better. Like net debt positions on average of about 20 companies that I looked at, you know, is positive. It's like $60 million positive, but ranges all the way up to $1.1 billion in terms of negative net debt, suggesting that there's a lot of companies with very little debt and large working capital positions, which is what we're sitting at right now. The industry itself is in a very good position, but all we're sort of saying here is that their ability to generate that same level of free cash flow is a bit at risk now because of the cost inflation.
Yeah. All right. So let me ask you this then. Since I first got back into the miners at the end of 2015, almost by luck, that I caught that low, you know, the HUI was down at 100 or whatever. One of my core positions the entire time in my IRA has been Franco Nevada.
Yep.
And all the time, I mean, regardless of the price fluctuations, it just seems like it goes up every year. I mean, consistently just goes higher. That is a royalty company. So given this scenario that we've just kind of walked through, is this maybe a time, just generally speaking for investors, to focus more on like royalty and, you know, streaming companies rather than the people that actually dig it out of the ground?
Like royalty companies, like when I did my piece on ESG, one thing that struck me as interesting is the low ESG footprint that royalty companies are given. So because they're not attached to the mine, so they're not giving them that footprint of the mine that the royalty is actually on. And so from an ESG generalist fund, a royalty company would actually be preferable to a mining company. So that's one thing. And then to your point, like if you want more leverage to the commodity and less leverage to the margin, which might get squeezed, royalties definitely make more sense. When you get into the streaming game, then you really have to understand the underlying asset more. Because you want a stream on a company's byproduct. And why, what I mean by that is that that commodity only generates less than 10% of the gross revenue. That means it's a commodity they don't really care about. Because if you talk to any CEO of any company that's trying to bring a project into development, the last thing that they want to do is put a stream on one of their main products.
Sure.
Because that's the leverage your equity investor is trying to gain. And you're basically giving it away to a streaming company. So that might suggest something, reading the tea leaves, about the underlying asset and whether it's actually a good quality. So from my point of view, yes, a pure royalty company would make a lot of sense. But then you have to look at the portfolio of royalties that it's deriving the revenue from. Is it just two, or is it like a whole bunch, like a Franco Nevada or a Wheaton Precious, that's what you have to look at. And what's the growth related to? Because Sandstorm's a nice company. It's smaller market cap, potentially more growth, but a lot of that growth is linked up to, Hot Maden, which is a great asset in Turkey, but it's in Turkey. What's the capital going to be? When's it going to get into production? Blah, 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 blah. Whereas, a pure royalty company that's got a lot of assets diversified, that matters a lot less in terms of risk.
Yeah. I would imagine you follow royalty companies and Exploration Insights too.
Yes. And what I'm following, because it's Exploration Insights, is also the royalty companies that generate the actual royalties. Because the problem in this, over the last couple of years, not the problem, but the scenario that we've had, is a lot of capital has been raised and put into royalty companies because it's such an attractive, let's say, a business plan for people, mm-hmm. And then they could take their capital and give it to the exploration company, the developer, or even somebody, a private individual who has a 0.25% royalty on a project that he didn't even know about, and they buy that. Those are the kind of royalty companies you want that could get these royalties, that nobody knows about. And they don't have to buy it from the company. They don't have to buy it from anybody else. They can get right to a private vendor who, might have a situation where he needs the cash, and you can make a deal directly with them. So royalties, yes. Long-winded answer, but yes, if we see margins being squeezed and still the opportunity for gold to stay up over 1750 plus, and royalty companies definitely make sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me too. All right, so now those are the main couple of things I wanted to ask you about when we set up this call a couple of weeks ago. And then lo and behold, the rumors start flowing out Sunday night and Monday that Kirkland Lake has put itself basically up for sale. And then on Monday, late Monday, early Tuesday, here it comes, combining with Agnico Eagle. So, prescient timing for me, lucky timing for me to have you on. What do you think of all this, Joe?
Well, I mean, this is a trend that we've seen before, but, with Rand Gold and Barrick and with Newmont Gold Corp, Pan American, Tahoe, these mega mergers basically to generate more free cash flow, have a bigger market cap, more liquidity, higher dividends, to get that scale that would, again, to the initial question, attract that generalist investor. And this is in that same genre for sure. And, listening into the conference call, this is something that's been, they've been working for about 2 years between the two companies that they've been discussing it. So both companies represent high margin portfolios and then also low geopolitical risk. Most of their stuff is in Canada, Finland, Australia, low ESG footprint from both of them. So it's really a combination of like companies that are both based in Canada to create, as they say, a new Canadian champion, because they're basically saying, hey, Barrick's no longer a Canadian company. whereas we are because we've got most of our asset base actually in Canada. And so that would attract, if the generalist investor comes back or is interested again, that might attract the general investor over a Barrick or over a Newmont. And also what's nice about it is the integration risk for an Agnico is low because you're only really dealing with integrating two assets. And one asset, you already operate mines right near them already and have a pretty good understanding of how to open pit and a mill and operate in Northern Ontario. Their biggest risk is incorporating the asset in Australia, which I don't think would be that big of a deal because it runs by itself. So, but I think the issue here with the price action is that who does it benefit in terms of a shareholder? Mm-hmm. I think it's a great move for Agnico because I think Detour has a lot of growth, granted low grade, 0.8 grams. And, Fosterville brings you high margin, high grade ounces. The question for Kirkland shareholders, does it make sense for them? Because, when Randgold merged with Barrick, Barrick was offering Randgold diversification, because they've got assets in Nevada and all over the world, so you could diversify your African asset portfolio. But Kirkland already has that low risk geopolitical assets. It's already got high margin. It's got one of the best balance sheets in the industry with next to zero debt, and it pays dividends now. So then the question for the Kirkland guys, what is Agnico bringing me? Mm-hmm. And if anything, it's bringing you scale, and that's it. So, but the scale might not attract, your current investment base, but it might attract the generalists who may not have been interested in Agnico before. I don't know. But they do have about six shareholders, significant shareholders, and the top 10 that are the same shareholders. Mm-hmm. And I think they constitute about 18 to 20% of their outstanding shares. And I know during the call that they said their biggest shareholder of both was Van Eck, and their fund manager approved or was happy about the transaction. So yeah, I guess there will be some people happy about it, but I think it would be more of a head scratcher for Kirkland shareholders than it would be for Agnico.
Yeah, I would. Now, without veering off into investment advice, and if this is too close to it, you can just say it's too close to that. But and I'm just trying to think of the right way to ask this question. If someone had as part of a big old portfolio, you had $10,000 worth of Kirkland and $10,000 worth of Agnico Eagle, you're going to have $20,000 worth of the combined entity.
Yeah.
Is a company worth that? I mean, and again, now we got to talk about the percentage of your portfolio and all that kind of stuff. Does somebody, you sell half your Kirkland and keep the combined entity just because of how it works out. Do you see what I'm driving at? But I don't know if I'm asking it right, Joe.
Well, the thing is that, if you look at the exchange ratio, which was at that point a bit of a discount to where they were trading at that point, in June, up to June, the exchange ratio was quite a lot smaller, like much more favorable to Agnico. And it had only been since June and beyond when Kirkland started breaking out and outperforming Agnico and outperforming the GDX. And some of that reasoning is because of, they added, 10 million ounces of M&I mm-hmm. measured and indicated resources to Detour, granted low grade, again, 0.8, but significant ounces in, a low risk geopolitical risk jurisdiction where you're already operating. And then they also, found some new zones down plunge at Fosterville, suggesting that they had growth, but Agnico was potentially a little bit more challenged for growth. And so Agnico was getting a similar portfolio, low risk assets, low ESG footprint, high margin and growth, whereas Kirkland really wasn't. They're basically diluting their growth by going into Agnico.
Yeah.
If you get my point.
And I guess that's what maybe a better way to phrase it would be if you had 5% of your portfolio in Kirkland and 5% of your portfolio in Agnico, you combine it together, you got 10% now of your, And that would seem to be, I mean, is the merger beneficial enough to both that you would keep 10% in your portfolio, or you would say, ah, you know what, I'm going to pull that back? And
they're saying that they've got, you know, a couple of $1 billion in synergies from their operations in Northern Ontario and GNA. That's something that, might be helpful in terms of the valuation and the rationale to do it. Because again, this is another one of those, you know, quote unquote, merger of equals.
Right.
But what we see is a Rand Gold-like transfer of management, because really it's the Kirkland CEO that's becoming the CEO of the new Agnico. You know, and he's going to have all his people there. So he's going to be, so in terms of, you know, managing the asset base and that, he's going to have a pretty good idea of Fosterville and Detour. That's not going to be an issue.
Right.
His issue will be to find out more about the assets Agnico already knows about.
Given the way this is, that's probably the best way to do it, I would think.
Well, the thing is, again, I think it's mostly about scale.
Yeah.
Just like the other ones were, they're all about scale and being able to consistently generate free cash flow that you can consistently push out dividends while, you know, exploration. Because they also emphasized exploration during their conference call. But the problem becomes, you know, as you get bigger and bigger you get, it's harder to move the needle.
Right.
So a lot of that exploration would just be running to stand still and feeding the beast.
Yeah, right. All right, Joe, in our final couple of minutes, I have to ask you about commodities in general, but I guess specifically uranium and whether that's something, because this has been such a hot topic, well, for the past 6 weeks, but really the past 6 months. You could see this coming when Sprott Inc. bought out that uranium trust and vowed to buy physical uranium, which was eventually going to probably trickle through to the spot price. And so now here we are. But, you know, it's maybe a bigger, you know, green energy kind of story in that, you know, I mean, even what China put a thing out a couple of weeks ago about not building any more coal-fired plants.
The uranium story is, you know, a story that everyone recites and everybody knows very well. It's, again, just timing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about uranium right now is like the Sprott Trust. I mean, that's basically chewed up a lot of pounds in the current market that were not really available to anybody else. So that squeezing of the market generated the $50 per pound. But really what I'm looking out for is that, does that force the reactors, the energy companies to start, you know, signing long-term contracts?
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that impetus yet. And so will we see it? Will this trigger it? You know, I like the idea like you are talking about, like, hey, you know, if we want to lower our greenhouse gas emissions and nuclear energy is an alternative. And they're talking about these smaller and smaller reactors that could go to remote towns and that and run their power for them as opposed to using diesel and some other things. I think those are all good ideas. But the big impact on uranium will be, you know, the China story and all this other story in terms of the reactor bills. In the interim, this is very positive for equities in the near term. I don't know if it's sustainable. That's right. Only my question.
Do you like the longer term story though?
Oh yeah, no, I'd like the longer term story, and I do own a uranium stock. But then the question is, it's really a, you know, the other thing that you see, you know, about in terms of what we're seeing in supply chain, what have you, and permitting, that people that have permitted plants, permitted tailings facilities, and that have a huge advantage right now. It's impossible to permit things nowadays.
Yeah.
And that ability to have it already is very important in what you do with it. And so I can, you know, because a lot of the M&A that we've seen, like in Ontario and You know, it has been incremental M&A because just to, you know, find feed for plants that are running out of ore and they don't want to reclaim them and they don't want to, you know, start closing them down. So I think that's another thing that you would, if you're looking for juniors, that's another consideration is that, you know, could it feed this plant and is that of interest to this company? Are they mm-hmm. running out of ore? Blah, blah, blah. Is there a strategy there that might make sense? You know, so you might not need a standalone 5 million ounce deposit, maybe less than a million feeding a plant nearby with run of mine material might just do it, given the valuation that you're sitting at right now.
Sort of like early 20th century stuff where you just buy all the inputs. You know, if you're Coca-Cola, you buy the sugar farms, or the McDonald's buys the potato farms.
Exactly, because the thing is that's really the dichotomy that you're playing with in the current market is that maybe the generalist investor is not interested, but the industry is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, that's fascinating, Joe, and I'm glad to hear you're on top of that as well, because again, that just brings more value to Exploration Insights. And again, for everybody listening, Joe Mazumdar, publisher and editor, Exploration Insights newsletter, cranks it out weekly. You can find more about it, how much it costs, at explorationinsights.com. And of course, as has for years, gets a big TFMR thumbs up. I can tell you that. They do great work. Joe, thank you so much. I mean, the timing, especially with the Kirkland stuff, couldn't have been better. And I know you're very busy, but I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk.
Thanks very much, Craig. Always a pleasure. I look forward to talking to you and your subscribers again.
Yeah, we'll definitely do it again soon. And we'll do another one of these Thursday conversations again soon, too. But that's it for now. Thank you all for listening. Have a great rest of your day.